This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Thank you very much, Roger. Good morning to you. Good morning, world, as we come your way on the technology of the century that allows people to hear us all over the world. And we do hear from some of them occasionally in other parts of the planet. And that's always fun to compare notes with what's happening where they are and what's happening where you are. And where we are. And we're heading into a very busy time because today, with that kind of a weather forecast, Air Orion will be flying. We'll be flying down to Champaign, then driving to Rantoul for the Half Century of Progress show. We'll talk more about that a little bit later. And then, of course, next week, it's the granddaddy of the outdoor farm shows, the Farm Progress Show, Decatur, Illinois. That will be next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Oh, and you're still asking when the sandwich fair gets underway? It's always the Wednesday after Labor Day. And yes, Max and I will be there on different days to entertain folks, including you, I hope, at the sandwich fair. So anyway, we're going to check in this morning to talk markets with Rich Feltus of RJ O'Brien. We're going to check in with Jim Fazell to talk gardening and some of the solutions to problems you may be having in your garden or lawn this year. And then we're going to check in with Steve Alexander, who will talk about Hollywood coming to the Farm Progress Show. There's going to be a film debut at the Farm Progress Show this year. So a lot to happen here between now and 6 o'clock. We'll check in with Jim Fazell when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. We say good morning to Jim Fazell here on the Saturday Morning Show, and let me lead off, Jim, with a couple of listener questions, if I can.
Sure.
A lady at church said, I have nice red tomatoes, but I pick them off, and on the bottom of the tomato, there's a black spot. What can I do to stop that?
Well, I'll tell you, that's called blossom end rot. And it's not a disease. It's a physiological condition. Technically, there's a lack of calcium in the tissues, so the tissues never develop properly and they just fall out. Actually, you can cut that piece of the tomato off and the rest of the tomato should be just fine. Now, what happens when the plant is developing the first set of fruit? Those fruits develop so quickly that a lot of times they don't have enough calcium in them. Not much you can do about it except to wait till the plant begins to slow down a little bit, and eventually it will straighten itself out and the tomatoes will be fine. If you have this problem year after year, you might consider when the plant begins to set fruit, first thing in the year, just spray them with calcium or put some calcium on the ground to help increase. Actually, there's enough calcium in the soil, it's just that the plant can't pick it up. Along with this black thing, there are a lot of people that are talking about the black stems on tomato plants. That has to do with the amount of water that we had early in the spring. The stems rot off, and about the time you think you're going to get some tomatoes, the plant or that part of the plant wilts, and you're out of tomatoes for that plant. Now, late blight, early blight, alternaria, those are three diseases that cause that. The solution is to use varieties that are resistant to those diseases, and those you can buy either as seed or as plants. But you need to use resistant varieties. Then give them plenty of room to grow. That helps with the blossom end rot as well. Give the plants plenty of room to grow.
Question number two from our crop reporter in central Illinois. He said, ask Jim why the maple trees in central Illinois are losing leaves, even if the leaves are still green.
Still green. Well, there are a couple things. If you look closely, there may be spots on those leaves. There's a disease called maple tar spot, so you have little specks on the leaf that turn black at this time of year. There's also anthracnose, but you'd normally see that because that's dead edges of the leaf. There's a situation called summer leaf drop, which will occur. If the plants grow very vigorously in the spring, as they did this year, they may develop a bigger crown and more leaves than what they can sustain when things become a little more stressful, and they'll just shed leaves. But there's another thing that's happening right now, and we see this all over our area. It's called the maple petiole borer. Now, if the leaves come off with only half the petiole on them, look very closely at that petiole, and you'll probably find that it's a little bit hollow right where it broke off from the rest of the leaf. If that's the case, you have the petiole borer. That's the larva of a little tiny microscopic almost wasp. You'll never see the wasp. You're never going to see the borer, and it really doesn't hurt anything. It's not going to take very many leaves off the tree, even though if you look at the ground, you say, my gosh, it's fall here already, but the leaves are green. Not really a serious problem. It does happen, and you may never see it again. Once in a while, it'll happen, and then for some peculiar reason, the insects that cause that just disappear. You never see them.
That's Mother Nature, I guess.
That's Mother Nature, and as long as you have plenty of leaves on the tree, there's nothing to worry about.
Well, I know you've got questions every week and every day, so you've got mine answered. Now, what about some of yours?
Well, we have a question from some people. In fact, several people who have arrowwood viburnums, and they're saying, well, you know, arrowwood viburnums, we've had them for a while, but all of a sudden they begin to stink. I hate to say that word, but you know, that's absolutely true. These particular viburnums, if they're affected by primarily insects, they begin to put out this tremendous smell, which smells awful. It smells like a garbage dump, and it's a direct result of the plants trying to wall off these invaders. There are two kinds that can cause this. One is the borer that affects those plants right at the stem line, at the soil line, or what we have now are these leaf beetles. Viburnum leaf beetle puts little holes in the leaves all over the tree. It looks like it was shot by a shotgun. All over the bush. This time of year, there's not an awful lot that you can do because the damage has already been done. And quite frankly, it's become such a problem that we're telling people, don't plant arrowwood viburnum. In fact, if you're having the difficulty, try to replace them because it's really a serious situation. But if we can keep an area clear of those plants for 3 or 4 years, these bugs will disappear and you won't have the problem again. Otherwise, the thing that you could try would be to spray the foliage with 7 insecticide, but it's a little late to do that because the damage has already been done. So anyway, arrowwood viburnum, it's a wonderful plant, but does have this particular habit. Some of the other viburnums will do that as well. Not very nice, but it's, again, a part of nature where these plants are trying to protect themselves. Now, the next thing that we're getting questions about is the sod webworms. People are saying, yeah, I'm not cutting the grass, and I've got flocks of these little moths flying at knee high all over the lawn right in front of the lawnmower. Well, those are the adults of the sod webworm. We've talked about these before. These insects are laying eggs right now, which will hatch into little larvae that will eat the grass off in about 2 weeks. So if you wait another week and then treat the entire lawn with 7 insecticide again, this will kill these larvae off as they're beginning to hatch from the eggs, and you will rescue your grass for the rest of the season. Of course, grubs are a problem right now, too, and we're beginning to see a little bit of the grub problem show up. Grubs, you can't use the long-term things like merit at this time of year because the grubs will do too much damage before it becomes activated. So you'll want to use something like Dilox or, again, 7 insecticide. Now, if you use 7 on the grubs, you want to soak it in with about an inch of water because the grubs are not at the surface as the sod webworms are. So if you're going to use 7 or Dilox, either one, as soon as you put the material down, go ahead and soak the lawn with about an inch of water, or wait for nature to do it if it's going to do it within a day or so. But if you don't get the ground soaked within a day or so, you've wasted your efforts of trying to eliminate the problem. Now, another question about lawns, why is there so much crabgrass and so many broad-leafed weeds showing up now? Well, this is two reasons. If the material that you put down to prevent crabgrass, these are the crabgrass preventers like Halts and so forth, that you put down early in the season, were put down too early with all that moisture that we had, they're gone. and you're not going to have any protection anymore. This is called breakthrough. Now, breakthrough occurs when you have lack of the preventative insect herbicide, and you have good growing conditions for the weeds, but not good growing conditions for the turf grass. Now, we had a situation where it was too dry, the turf grass wasn't growing, it was too hot, so the crabgrass and some of these broad-leafed weeds got a chance to get started, and when they do that, they're going to grow vigorously, which they're doing right now. Crabgrass, I wouldn't do anything about it. Make sure that you get the crabgrass preventer down next spring. And with your broad-leafed weeds, you actually can still do something with some of the broad-leafed herbicides, the broad-spectrum herbicides. Spray those things, particularly if they have not made seed as yet, and you'll get them out of the way before they can make seed, so you should have less problem next year. Now, one last thing I want to talk about is the grasses in the ground covers. A lot of folks are having trouble with their ground cover plantings like the vinca and so forth, or in their flower and shrub borders with a lot of grass growing in. What can you do about it? Well, first of all, the best thing to do with it is pull it. But there is a herbicide. It's called Fluazafop or Fusilade, strange name. But it can be sprayed over the top of any of your broadleaf plants. It will kill only the grass. Now, you need to keep it off your lawn because it'll kill lawn grasses as well. But out in your shrub beds or your ground cover or flower beds, you can spray this material carefully on the grass itself, not worrying about getting it on any of the broadleaf plants, because it will kill the grass without killing any of the broadleaf plants, and it works very nicely. A really amazing material. It works just the reverse of the stuff that you put on the lawns to get rid of broadleaf plants.
Well, anyway, you've answered a lot of questions this morning, sir.
Yes, a lot of questions, and we keep getting them at this time of year. Actually, next week, our trees are in trouble, and we're going to talk about that next week, cover that pretty thoroughly so that some of the folks that are having those problems will know what's causing it and what to do about it.
All right. As always, we thank you for your expertise. That's our visit this week with Jim Fazell, our specialist in ornamental horticulture here on the Saturday Morning Show. 23 minutes after 5 o'clock, the beginning of a beautiful Saturday across much of the Midwest. And earlier, I talked about a movie debut at the Farm Progress Show next week. So let's get that story as we say good morning to Steve Alexander.
Joining me on the telephone is Sam Goldberg. He is a producer of a new feature film called Silo. And this is, Sam, very interesting in that I believe this is the first time a film has debuted at the Farm Progress Show, is it not?
Yeah, that's what they're telling me. Pretty excited about it.
Let's talk about Silo. It's a film about grain entrapment, and we in Farming America know all too well about these incidents. And how did you get started on making this film?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me and, you know, giving me a platform to talk about this movie. It's been 5+ years in the making. I was approached by a director named Marshall Burnett. He was living in Nashville, Tennessee, producing and directing a different film. And he was driving home one night and heard an NPR story about a grain entrapment incident in Mount Carroll, Illinois, where 3 teenage boys went into a grain bin and 2 of them sadly passed away and were engulfed in the grain. The 3rd boy was rescued after a very long and complex rescue. He thought it would be a really interesting idea for a film. And so we sought out to make a movie 5 years ago. And as it often goes in our industry, it took a little while, but last summer, we filmed it in Kentucky and in Iowa, and we are, as you mentioned, launching it and releasing it at the Farm Progress Show, and you know, quite excited about it, hopefully to be the first film to ever do that.
Can you walk us through the plot?
Yeah, absolutely. The plot of the film takes place over the course of 24 hours in a small town, and it follows a few different stories. It's an ensemble movie, you know, like the film Crash or Traffic or Magnolia, some successful movies that really follow a few characters whose lives intersect over any, you know, one subject. And our movie follows an 18-year-old boy and his mom, as well as a farmer and his dad, and a local volunteer fire chief. And, you know, sometime into the movie, an incident happens, the boy gets trapped, and the rest of the film follows a pretty thrilling rescue operation to try and get him out. And it's definitely a drama, you know, it's a serious movie about people who are having a very tough time in their lives, trying to make their way through a day that seems impossible. And their lives intersect in such a way that they're forced to forgive one another, deal with issues that have kind of long passed but never fully been dealt with, and all the while, you know, try and get this boy out of a really, really challenging circumstance.
Does your film incorporate any of the newer life-saving techniques that are being used by fire departments?
It does. It does. There is a green tube that's very prevalent and important in our film. There's a green tube plot line, basically, where, you know, what happens often in small towns, you know, what we learned through our research is a lot of small town volunteer fire departments may not have a green tube, or even if they do, they may not have the proper training with a green tube. So they often have to wait for a big city fire department to show up with the proper training and equipment. And that's exactly what happens in our movie. There's a waiting game, and the local firefighters have to keep this boy alive however they can without actually touching the grain, because it's so dangerous. It's like an avalanche that could cascade on him. And so that's exactly right. There's a big sort of element of the new training techniques and technology that hopefully, you know, will save the boy's life. And in the process of making this movie, I'm proud to say that we've worked with some companies that have then donated green tubes to local fire departments. And a big part of our initiative is both getting people to think twice about getting into their bins without the proper safety precautions in the first place, but then also making sure that as much as we can assist, you know, fire departments in the acquisition of green tubes and training with the green tubes, because it is really complex. You know, how do you get somebody out of that? It's just so complex, and that's why these are such difficult scenarios. And our movie, you know, puts somebody in that situation and, you know, hopefully keeps people entertained and interested in what happens.
Tell me about how people can see this at the Farm Progress Show and beyond.
Yeah, so we will be at lot 2174 at the Farm Progress Show. We're actually right next to Syngenta Square, which I believe is a beer garden. We'll have a large tent. Inside of that tent, we'll have a projector, and every half an hour from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., we'll be showing our trailer of the film, and we'll be releasing it online at the same time. So people can come and every half hour have a little popcorn, sit down, watch the trailer, and then we'll also be sharing our tent with the Grain Handling Safety Coalition, which is a fantastic organization that teaches people farm safety, in particular grain-related safety. And they'll be there doing a variety of safety demonstrations both inside and outside of our tent. And then throughout the day, I think it's 11:15 a.m., 12:45 p.m., and 2:15 p.m., Tuesday through Thursday, we'll be doing panel discussions with farm safety experts, with some mental health experts talking about generational farming and the stresses of modern-day farming. And then the three star actors of our film, Jim Parrick, Jeremy Holm, and Jack DeFalco, will also be in attendance in panel discussions and taking pictures and talking about their experience with the film and all the research they did. And then additionally, we're on Facebook at Silo the Film, and our website is silothefilm.com. And we're encouraging people to sign up to host a screening in their local areas. You know, we're doing a unique way of distributing this film. We're trying to empower people to get together and have a public way to screen this movie, and then use our discussion guide, which we've created with the Grain Handling Safety Coalition, to talk more about the film and farm safety. So we're calling that the Silo Community Screening Campaign. And if you go to our website, silothefilm.com, you'll be able to host a screening or learn where you can see the movie upcoming.
Sam Goldberg, the producer of a film called Silo, which debuts at the Farm Progress Show next week.
Thank you, Roger, and thank you for that good forecast. It sounds like good flying weather today, and that can be a challenge this time of the year with thunderstorms popping up, but sounds like a good day for flying Air Orion down to Frasca Field on the north side of Champaign, and then we'll drive to Rantoul and stop in at the Half Century of Progress Show. Max is already there, and I'll be talking about some of the activity that we'll have for you today if you're coming to the Half Century of Progress Show. But right now, welcome to Samuelson Says. I'm Orion, this morning with this question. cow milking is sexual abuse. Just about any area of food production, whether it be plant-based or animal-based, at one time or another comes under attack from somebody. And that's why this week's headline on Samuelson Says is the most unusual one I think I have ever used. But it comes from the New York University's Women's and Gender Studies Program at Brockport State University in New York State. And the paper insists that milking cows is comparable to sexual abuse, emotional trauma related to pregnancy, and non-consensual hormone and use. The author then writes, throughout our lives, we are offered an idealized image of dairy cows, where these animals graze on beautiful pastures, have room to play, and are comforted in spacious areas in which to sleep. We are presented with images of a life well lived, but when it comes to the deaths of those same animals, the picture-perfect story comes to grim reality. The paper then continues, the outdated stereotype about women being caretakers and most importantly child bearers remains consistent in the dairy industry, especially when we take into account the means through which these animals are exploited. A few brief examples include rape or sexual assault, non-consensual hormone treatments, and emotional trauma related to pregnancy. Dairy cows are forcibly impregnated, mainly by artificial insemination, or raped, in order to constantly produce milk for humans to consume. The paper goes on to say a lot more, but I think that's enough that I'll share with you because, number one, it points out that the people who wrote the paper have no idea that if you don't milk cows, they're going to become ill and could eventually perish. Cows have to be milked 2 or 3 times a day to stay in good health. But the people who wrote the paper apparently haven't been on a dairy farm or around dairy animals to know that milking is an important part of a dairy cow's health. Will it ever end? That's Samuelson Says, a presentation of Tribune Radio Networks. 19 minutes before 6 o'clock here on this Saturday morning, and we never know where guests on this show will be spending time while we're doing the broadcast. That's the case with our next guest, Rich Feltus, R.J. O'Brien, who joins us from, well, you'll find out, to talk markets when we continue on the Saturday morning show. Well, to talk markets here on the Saturday morning show, as we do every week, we're going by long-distance phone to Colorado. That's where we find Rich Feltus of R.J. O'Brien, who we occasionally visit with here on the Saturday morning show. Good morning to you, Rich, and what takes you to Colorado?
Well, yearly, R.J. O'Brien brings out all of their clients for a meeting, our introducing broker clients primarily. We're the largest IB FCM in the world, and we have over 300 gathering here just outside of Denver in Aurora, Colorado, in the new Gaylord Resort that's just open. And we're going to be talking markets and trade ideas and, of course, the importance of compliance and staying straight with the CFTC all over the next day and a half. And we've got a great list of speakers, and that has drawn in a good crowd this year.
What will you be, well, I shouldn't ask this because I think I know, but what topic will you be covering at this gathering?
Well, I'll be chairing or moderating a grain panel, and we're going to be going over the, we got two distinguished speakers that are on the panel. I'll be making some comments myself regarding the latest on the trade update. And we hopefully are going to be providing some directional guidance. And I think from a little bit firmer foundation orient, typically our company has this meeting in March or April. And since we're having this now at the end of August, we know more than we typically do in the late winter, early spring. We know U.S. crops are nearing maturity. We know we've got big small grain crops across Europe and the former Soviet Union. We know that our markets are globally, economically, slowing down. And we also know, especially after the news this morning, that any imminent breakthrough with China trade seems very unlikely. So I think that's going to give us a little bit better foundation to make some price forecasts going forward.
And, of course, we just finished one of the annual summer tours. Are we ever going to get real numbers on what we're seeing with the weather delays we've had this year?
Well, two comments on that, and it's a very good question, Orion, with regards to the Pro Farmer Tour. As I look at all the numbers, and what I look at, Orion, is the percentage decline in the Pro Farmer corn yield versus last year. And I compare that against the percentage decline that USDA gave us in their corn yields on the August crop report. And surprisingly, USDA is right in the ballpark. Pro Farmer numbers are, in effect, confirming the USDA corn yield number. Now, soybeans, it's an entirely different story. The pod counts are well down. We know that the beans are still podding. A lot is going to depend on the length of the growing season and the first frost date. But our pod count, for example, in the state of Illinois is just a little bit better than it was in 2012. And in 2012, Orion, we had a final soybean yield in the state of Illinois of 43 bushels an acre. USDA at the August crop report gave us a soybean yield for Illinois of 55 bushels per acre. So if there is any surprise, it's going, I think, be in the soybean sector. But in answer to your question, I think the September crop report coming up is just a modest exercise in replicating what they said in August. The real important number will be in October. There, USDA will have harvested a number of their sample plots, processed them, and weighed them through their labs. And that will be a big part of the yield forecast that we get in October. That's really going to be the first, I think, reliable crop report of the season because of this very unusual growing season that we've been living through.
I think probably one of the most contentious points coming out of the USDA reports is that corn yield per acre. What's your current feeling on that?
Well, my view is that the corn yield will be coming down, perhaps 3 to 4, maybe even 5 bushels an acre from USDA's 169. However, that is not enough of a yield cut to really change the overall narrative of adequate supplies. And we are at the time of the in the calendar year as we're transitioning from supply focused to demand focused, when the demand news becomes more important. New crop corn sales, Orion, are tracking 7 million tons out of U.S. below what they were a year ago. We know that even though Gulf corn values have eroded and Argentine corn premiums have advanced, Argentine corn is still the cheapest corn in the world. And we had another export sales report yesterday, which was quite frankly disappointing on our weekly corn export sales. So even though this corn crop may be shrinking, there's a fear that the demand is also shrinking. It's just not going to be enough until we get verification in October that perhaps there is a big surprise or there's a very early freeze that takes a lot of test weight out of the corn and hence yield and production. Save those events, this transitioning of focus to demand, I think, is going to be what we start running on in terms of market primary factor focus after the October crop report.
One of the areas that Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue is being challenged by farmers is the markets that we have lost because of the trade war, and a lot of farmers are saying we'll not get them back. What do you feel on that?
Well, I think there is some truth to that, maybe even more than some. The Secretary has also said that over the last decade, the U.S. soybean farmer has probably become too reliant on the Chinese market. There was an excellent story by the Reuters folks earlier this week about the North Dakota soybean farmer, now one of in the top five soybean producing states, and the fact that they don't have the crushing infrastructure up there as a backstop to take the beans vis-a-vis their primary outlook via shuttle trains out to the PNW to load in vessels to go to China. That has virtually dried up and impacted those upper grade plains producers more than your central Midwest producers. China right now, or in last week, stated publicly that they can bridge the gap in their soybean needs through the fourth quarter of 2019. We know their crush rate is down. We know their hog numbers are way down. And we know they're committed to diversifying as much as possible away from the U.S. in terms of sourcing soybeans. It looks to us, and again, this comes indirectly through my contacts at the Commodity Markets Council in Washington, that it's unlikely that this trade fracas is going to be resolved prior to the 2020 election. I think it's well known in Washington and Beijing that the Chinese would prefer a Trump loss, that they would have an easier trade negotiating partner with a Democratic president. And it appears now that we're in a waiting game on the part of the Chinese to wait out this president and hope that he doesn't survive another 4 years. So your basic question, I think it's correct. At least through the fall elections next year, there doesn't look to be much hope of gaining back much of this very important Chinese soybean demand market that has really been a boom to U.S. soybean production.
And finally, the Chinese government said they weren't buying any more ag products from the United States, but yet this past week we reported a couple of export sales. Are they changing their mind, or was that done before they made the announcement?
Well, it's not. I know what you're referring to, and it's not entirely clear whether that that purchase was a new purchase or simply rolling that purchase from an undecided into a known origin. The Chinese are very adept at those kind of games. They're well aware of how our markets work and how to play our markets to their advantage in terms of their hedging strategies. After the events this morning, though, with these additional tariffs that have been announced soon after the opening here in Chicago on Friday, the odds of any additional purchases here in the near term appear to be very scant, unless there's some sort of a breakthrough on the trade talks and we resume at least a goodwill resumption of U.S. soybean purchases at a modest scale. At this point, that's, I think, the most we can hope for.
As always, we thank you, and particularly this morning, for taking time away from that conference in Colorado, and we'll stay in touch with you as we get more reports. Our visit with Rich Feltus, R.J. O'Brien in Chicago, here on the Saturday Morning Show. USDA released the August cattle on feed report yesterday, and here are the numbers. Cattle and calves on feed in the United States, 11,100,000 head as of August 1st. That inventory was slightly above August 1st of 2018, and it is the highest August 1st inventory since the series began in 1996. Placements in feedlots during July totaled 1,710,000 head, 2% below 2018. And marketings of fed cattle during July totaled 2 million head, 7% above 2018. Those are the numbers the market will be trading when we resume trading on Monday. Now, as I said, a busy time in the farm department here at WGN, because Max and I will be on the road. Max is in Rantoul, Illinois, and we'll be there through tomorrow for the Half Century of Progress show. I'll be flying down later today to join Max on stage at 3 o'clock this afternoon with our band, The Back Page, and we'll spend an hour with you in the entertainment tent, and we hope you'll stop by and say hello. And then, of course, next week, it's the Farm Progress Show, Decatur, Illinois, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Max will be appearing at several of the exhibits on those 3 days. And I'll be at the University of Illinois exhibit every day at 10 o'clock in the morning, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And 600 exhibitors at the Farm Progress Show this week. So there'll be more than enough to spend a day or two trying to see everything that's new. And one of the things Matt Youngman has talked about, and Max has also talked about, is the surprising number, in light of the farm situation financially, a surprising number of new tractors being introduced at the Farm Progress Show this year. And so we look forward to seeing you there. And as you heard earlier, there will be the debut of a Hollywood film all 3 days at the Farm Progress Show. And that, of course, is located at Decatur, Illinois. Every other year we're at Decatur, and every other year we're at Boone, Iowa, so that's where we'll be next year. But this year it is Decatur. Stop by and say hello. As we ended the trading week yesterday, these are the numbers. Livestock futures, the December lean hog contract down $2.60 a hundredweight. And the market will start at 58.77 on Monday. October live cattle down $1.52. They'll start at $99.40 Monday. And October feeder cattle down $3.05. That means they'll start Monday at $132.52 a hundredweight. Grain trade, the December wheat contract up 5.25 cents yesterday. December corn, though, dropped 4 cents in the Friday trade. November soybeans took the big hit yesterday, down 13.75 cents a bushel. So that's our wrap for this week on the Saturday Morning Show. We'll see you later today at the Half Century of Progress Show in Decatur, Illinois. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Bob Ferguson for doing the engineering work. And we'll look forward to being with you again next Saturday morning.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.